I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. And today I have a special guest who, before I pressed record, has already had me laughing this morning with pleasure. That's Paula Wharton, who tells me that she was born in 1947 in British Guyana, as it was then called. She went to England. She got married. She had three children. And via a very circuitous route, she ended up in Canada. And very shortly after was divorced and struggled for many years, but she got through it and passed university courses with flying colors. You're going to hear all about that. And many years later, happily met her second husband. And as she says, the rest is history. But the other thing that I want to make sure that we talk about today, Paula, is that you've played a really significant role in your community in Sudbury. And I was reading in an interview with you in your capacity as the former chair of the Greater Sudbury Police's Racial and Multicultural Relations Advisory Board. That's a mouthful. And I'd love to talk to you about that because, of course, in the current climate, your direct experience with police in a smaller community is tremendously important. And I know there'll be lessons for all of us to think about and heed while we talk. But in the meantime, welcome to Grandmothers on the Move, Paula. It is a pleasure to have you here today.
It is my pleasure to be talking to you. And I'm enjoying this. And I'm glad this is not video. You can't see me because I'm curled up in bed with my book. I stayed here with my cup of tea and waited for this interview. And I'm feeling so happy and relaxed and wonderful, as grandmothers should feel, because we don't have to go to work anymore.
Absolutely. I love that image more than if we were doing video. And what a wonderful way to have a conversation, because it really should be relaxed. And in the midst of this extraordinary moment in history, you have to take these small pleasures and moments of relaxation more seriously, I think.
Quite right. So I've got my head tied with a head tie. It's always tied up. It's so good. I don't have to work, so I don't have to comb my hair. And nobody could see what's under there. I tied a piece of fabric around my body because it's good for wiping your hands in and everything when you're doing stuff. So that's how I am, curled up in my bed, talking about grandmothers and the role we play in this world.
Fantastic. I just love it. There were these really delicious nuggets in the little, very short bio you sent about a very extraordinary life that you've lived. And I thought I would start by asking you to fill in some of it, because I know that when you came to Canada, it was not an easy time. It was not an obvious move to
make. You're quite right, Elena. Let me tell you what happened with that very quickly. When I came, I kind of gave my husband an ultimatum and said, I'm giving you 4 months to be a good husband and father, and I'm no longer going to put up with this nonsense of what you think that every woman should put up with, you going out with many women at the same time. So I am going to tell you right now, I'm not going to put up with it. And in 4 months, he seemed to be worse. So he moved and left me and 4 children in Windsor in an apartment. And I had no job, no money, and he was gone. Well, I kept thinking he's going to come back. He's going to come back. He must come back. He just can't leave a black woman in this white world here and 3 little children. And he didn't come back. So I called immigration and I asked them, could you please deport me and 3 children? Back to Guyana, where my father is and my brothers are. I want to go home. And he said, lady, we don't run a travel agency that we could send people back when they don't like it in this country. But now I can laugh at that. I can't even imagine I did such a crazy thing. But I did. People are trying to stay in Canada. I want to go home. But this was 1976. And the immigration officer, who's probably dead now, because it's been so long, 40 years or more. But I asked him, to please find a way to send me back home. And he said, lady, after talking with you, I feel that you're such a bright person. Where are you from? I said, Guyana. He said, well, lady, why don't you go to school? He asked me where I lived in Venice, and I told him, just by the bridge to Detroit, just under the bridge. He said, you know what's there? The University of Windsor. Why don't you go to school? I said, well, I haven't been to school since I was 15. If I remember well, I was a bright girl. I had like grade 13 when I was 15 years old. So he said, well, lady, you should go to school. If you walk out your door and walk about 5 blocks, you'll be right at the University of Windsor. And you know, I got off the phone, stopped crying for the first time in months. And I took my daughter's hand. She was 3 years old. And we got dressed. Depression is an awful thing. I hadn't got dressed or bathed or combed my hair in a long time. But that man, whoever he is, my first angel in this country, he told me to go to school. And I walked onto the campus with my daughter and never left for over 7 years. I walked in there and met another angel and another angel. And my life has been that way. I'm sorry I don't focus on the negative once I was alone and crying and lost and so on. But it worked out. I passed.
Right.
And I help a lot of people to pass now. Well, I'm not using the word pass like they use it in America. You pass as a white. I'm black as ever. I passed courses, impossible things that I didn't think I could ever do. And life became better, but it was hard. It was hard. Being on welfare is not an easy thing. It's very demeaning. It is for a woman who had been working all her life, we're suddenly depending on help. But that's why I like Pierre Trudeau, because he was the one who was helping me to stay alive and survive. That's a long story that I thought would be short.
No, that's the short version of what really happened, I think. I mean, the strength of spirit that it takes. Even if somebody makes a suggestion,
it's
amazing that somebody really heard you and thought this woman should go to university. But,
exactly. You
know, easy to say, not easy to do, especially if you're living in hard circumstances.
You're quite right, you know, Ilana. It's not easy. I just said it like, but I've told this story a million times, so it becomes easier to tell. And of course, it changes all the time. It becomes like smooth. But it wasn't smooth. I remember telling myself, Paula, you have to bathe. You got to put on some clothes. You can't just go out at house like this. And that was hard. When you're so depressed and so down, and I didn't have a single brother or sister living in this country, nobody living in the country or living in Windsor, living in Canada, just me and my 3 children. And they're looking to me for help. And I am like, I can't help you. I want to die. But if I die, who's going to look after the kids? And that's how hard it was. I'm glad you reminded me that it wasn't just easy to get up and go to that university. And had I not met a wonderful woman named Camilla, registering people at a university, I also would not have stayed. It was very, very scary. Then she asked, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. I don't want to do anything. Do you want to do soc or psych? It's like, what's that? I'm 9 years old. I don't know what soc is. Now I know what sociology, psychology. I taught it now for 20 years. But then I didn't know. And this woman says, never mind, don't cry. Then she said, is your name Paula? I said, yes, but I don't know anybody in Windsor. How would you know my name? She said, I met your husband at a university pub and he told me to go and look for you because he had just left you, but you were a wonderful person. Oh, I cried even louder. What a stupid man, I thought. What a very stupid man.
Wow.
And this wonderful woman said, Paula, my name is Camilla, and I am going to register you for 2 philosophy courses because you need to find out why you're alive, why you're here, what's going to happen to you. She says, I'm just doing my master's in sociology and volunteering here for the day, but it's wonderful that I met you. I said, well, I don't have any money to pay. She says, yes, you do. I'm going to go to that same husband of yours. In those days, it was $120 a course or something like that. And she went and got money for 2 courses from him.
Are you serious?
And I'm serious. That was my second angel in the whole world. And she became my mentor, my friend, and everything. Camilla Colehurst. That's her name.
Wow.
She's wonderful. True. So, and I keep meeting angels like that all the time. I hope I am now an angel to many.
Yes, I'm absolutely sure of that. And you were the youngest of 15 children.
Right.
So to be in Windsor with three of your own and no support network, no family, having grown up in a large family with, I'm sure, right, many people around, it must have been so challenging to be so alone. Yeah.
Right.
What did you do with your children when you went to school? Like, how did you manage it?
Well, there were 7, 8, and 3. So the two of them were at school. I chose my courses around their times. I would be home by 4 o'clock. And Shay, I took with me everywhere I went. She's been in university since she's 3.
And oh, wow.
Maybe that's why she only did 1 degree and decided, I don't want to do no stay in school long like Sean and Nicole. No, I'm getting 1 degree. I'm going to be a physiotherapist and get an apartment and I'll go to the bar. She's just done with university, that kid. And that's because she went when she was 3 and we always went to school. So that's how I managed. I never had a babysitter. And that's because fortunately I was given welfare and I knew how to spend a little bit of money. I could cook food for a week with $20. Those are the things you learn when you're in a big family in an underdeveloped country. And then you come here, you could survive anything, anything.
Yeah. And with the work I used to do a long time ago, we were talking about women and budgets and the women in the economy. And I remember hearing from a woman who said to me, women should all be the ministers of finance in all of their countries, right, because we know exactly how to make 5 cents stretch as far as 20 cents.
She is so, so correct. You know, I remember I didn't have a dollar when my husband left. One day I found a lot of pennies. And my son, is ever hears this interview, he will recognize this part. And I counted out like 86 pennies, something like that. And I gave it to him. And I said, Sean, you see, he was 7. In those days, they sell cigarettes to kids. So if you walk across this train line and go there, there's a restaurant right here called the Ponderosa. And if you go there and give them this money, they'll give you a pack of cigarettes. My son went, this is a story that mothers shouldn't tell. People shouldn't tell. It's a true story. He became a doctor. In any case, he doesn't like smoking to this day. But he went with that money and he came back with a pack of cigarettes. And I taught myself to smoke and coughed and coughed and whatever. But Sean said many years later, Mommy, that was the most humiliating thing I ever did, to give those people all those pennies. And then they had to give me like dimes or quarters to put in the machine to get the pack of cigarettes for you. You shouldn't have sent a little boy to buy cigarettes. I just said, man, I had to survive. Imagine sending a kid to borrow money to buy cigarettes, this thing that could kill you. There's a desperation that makes you feel you cannot survive. Either that, or you go call the immigration people and they tell you, go to school. I was lucky.
And also, there must have been something inside of you that found the strength to turn a corner and do something different.
It was the love of 14 brothers and sisters. When my mother died, she said, take care of the baby and take care of each other. And to this day, 73 years later, we all, those of us who are still alive, half of us are gone, we took care of each other to the end. And then I've never felt a day that I wasn't loved. My feet didn't touch the ground till I was 3 because I was always being lifted on the hips of somebody who was listening to mother. She said, take care of the baby. To this day, I couldn't tell you which of those 14 brothers and sisters I love the most, because that kind of love is for all of us. It's in our hearts. We gave that love to the second generation, and now that generation is giving it to the next. We're just a wonderfully lucky bunch of people. Therein lies the difference. When you know that you're passing through, you're not meant to be here, and you will not stay here forever, but you will survive and come out just fine.
And it's getting harder, I think, over time, harder and harder to believe that everything, not everyone, but everything will be just fine.
Right.
And we're talking today right in the midst of an outpouring of pain and fury and indignation, millennia of injustice, people taking to the streets right in the middle of a pandemic. Right. That's how urgent it feels. And Paula, I think it's so important to hear from our elders in these moments. It's important for the youth to be there fighting for their rights and for a better future. Yeah. I also want to hear from women like you. What are you seeing?
Well, Girl, at this moment, I will say to you, first off, I am tired. Mm-hmm. Having gone through all that I've gone through and using all this, the strength, the spiritual strength, emotional, physical strength, I feel totally depleted now. I just wish I could sit in a rocking chair, which I do a lot of, and rest, because I am tired. And I'm worried for my grandson in New York, who lives with Shay. That's her son, and she's married to a white man. So we've got a boy, a wonderfully brilliant and handsome grandson. He said, are you black? Yes, I'm black. Are you white? Yeah, I'm white. But the police might get me, because they mightn't get me right away, stop me right away, because I've got a light color, but my hair is knotty and curly. So, you know, I could get it. And so my poor daughter in New York is scared every time her son goes on the road. And I'm tired of feeling the pain. I felt it for Sean as a black boy out on the road, who gets stopped a lot in Toronto by police because he has dreads and he's very dark and he drives a nice car much of the time. So they would wonder, who's this guy in this Beamer with dreads, and stop him, only to know that he's going from one hospital to another hospital to do his job. And that's the pain I feel for my son. And that son, he and his wife, who is also a doctor, they are now getting a baby, and they had a gender reveal, and it's a boy. And at that moment, I wondered if Sean thought to himself, am I bringing a black boy into this world at this time? And that's how I feel. We mothers, grandmothers, are tired. We fought a good fight and we're tired, and it isn't easier for our grandchildren. That's what breaks my heart. You understand that?
I can't understand it viscerally because it's not my lived experience, but I can hear it and I know it to be true. And it's so unbearable that the human condition hasn't improved from one generation to the next.
Right. That's hard. My pain is also confusion, because I'm married to a white man for over 40 years. He's got all these three white children who think I'm their mother. I love these white people. You know, I'm a grandmother of 11, and all these wonderful grandchildren are mine. Mm-hmm. And I feel sometimes I have to defend that. Mm-hmm. This is a confusing world, and I'm quite right when you say, sometimes I didn't even know it, but I'm going to say it now. I'm angry. I'm angry at this world for putting me in the position of confusion. Should I hate them people picketing, or should I stand with them? Or should I come into my little corner in Sudbury with my little husband and my little life and my little friends and be peaceful and happy and forget their struggles? I don't know what to do. I didn't know that that place existed in me, where I feel this visceral anger and confusion.
That word that you're using, confusion, that's a powerful...
That's a confusion.
Yeah, it's a powerful feeling.
I didn't know that that was stronger than the peacefulness I feel. I live in a little house on a little lake in Sudbury. It's so idyllic. People come here to sit and look at the water and drink mint tea with me. When I go to Washington to my very many family members there, they don't tell me anything, but I feel that they look at me and say, you don't understand this black struggle. You don't understand what we put up with at work. Auntie Paula, you can't understand this because you live in a peaceful Sudbury little town with a white husband and white friends, and you've only had white students, and you don't understand how we get overlooked for jobs and how we can't let our kids, grown adult children, be on the road in the dark. We don't go to sleep till they come home. I feel for them, but like you, I've never been an American living in America. I don't know anything about what those people go through. I'm from Guyana, where it was peaceful. And then England, which their problems were far removed from a little person like me. So I was in my own little world very happily, making children and working. And then I come to Canada and for a while go through this shake up. And then I find my niche. And that was in helping others who had just come and who were lost.
These are hard times. And as someone who's traversed many worlds, Paula, what do you hear from your friends, other older women and grandmothers?
My friends, the black friends, are old like me and older. And they worked at nursing homes and they worked hard. And we're dying off, you know, one by one because we're getting old. But we talk sometimes about the pain we feel and that we go to bed tired at nights. We should be rested.
Mm-hmm.
We you should be rested. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just having a teepee erected in my backyard. It's not cheap, but I'm getting it done because I need to gather some of my friends together and go in there and smudge and have a fire and just relax our spirits. And that's why I'm putting that teepee up there. I know an elder in Sudbury. I've got some contacts. So an elder is having it done, doing it for me. And that's because I'm looking for anything that is going to calm my spirit and my friend's spirit. Anybody who wants to use the teepee for a weekend can go there and come out of there refreshed. That's what I'm doing for my friends up here, black and white.
You know, I hear you actually working hard to restore some sense of peace, to heal the spirit, and also to find expression for, as you put it, your confusion and your anger.
That's what you brought that out of me. I only said to you at the beginning that I was tired. Mm-hmm. I'm lying in the bed here and propped up with two pillows and my book there. And I should be rested. I've been retired 12 years or so. Right. And I should be rested. Physically, maybe I'm rested. Mm-hmm. But even that is challenged with mental exhaustion and emotional exhaustion. I only meant to say that I was tired, but to let you into the gravity, let you into my soul mm-hmm. and the gravity of things. You know, I had a black friend tell me yesterday, she says, Paul, I think I wouldn't mind checking out. I can't take any more of this place. I'm ready to go. And I said, you can't be crazy. Don't leave me. As a matter of fact, come over tomorrow. The weather's supposed to be good. Let us sit by the lake and drink a beer or something bad, do bad things.
Right.
she said, well, I'm so tired of this goddamn Trump and all these things. Well, she's married to a white guy. So she's had her problems compounded because when she meets up with the white friends, her husband's friends, they don't see things like she sees it, a black woman. So she's either having to shut her mouth or challenge them.
Right.
And it becomes tiring, very tiring. So she says, at 8 to 4, I don't want to live anymore. She says, I've had enough. And when I got off the phone from her, I thought, hell, I don't want to die. Mm-hmm. I've just made my husband learn to cook and told him that I've cooked for him for 40 years. He has to cook for me for 40 years. He says, Paula, I'm 8 to 2. I don't live for 40 years. I said, I'm going to keep you alive for 40 years.
What's your favorite dish?
Curry chicken.
He owes you a lot of curry chickens, Paula.
He does. He does. Paula, I always thought I'd die at 8 to 5. I said, no, you're not. You got to cook for me for 40 years to make up for the 40 I cooked for you. So now he says, but I don't know how to cook. I said, Google it. So I bought him a notebook and he's writing out recipes like crazy. So I'm inviting all of Sudbury. You know, the police chief stops in to see us sometimes. I've been dealing with them five police chiefs back. Wow. And this last one here who came up from Toronto, Paul Pedersen, is among the best. And I invite him over to fry plantain at my house while I cook curry chicken for he and his wife and anybody else who I get on the phone who wants to come over and meet the chief. A lot of black people come to meet him and see what a wonderful man he is. He sent me a wonderful letter last week because of what is happening. So he said, oh, Paula, I thought I should reach out to you and your family and your friends in the black community and let you know that we don't condone what's happening. And what's happening in America is an example for us of what not to do. When COVID is done, we'll get back to having more get-togethers.
Being the chair of the
Police
advisory yeah. of the Racial and Multicultural mm-hmm. Relations Advisory Board.
Yes. That's a big mouthful.
It is. that must also be tiring. It's an extraordinary contribution to make. You've got your foot in many different worlds, trying to yeah. mediate and bring them together. But what was your experience? Were there issues that you were able to bring forward that you really felt something moved?
Good question. At first, I thought that all we were doing, meeting once a month or whatever it was, every 3 weeks, all I thought we were doing, it looked to me like we were just having meetings about meetings. We were talking about the meeting and what happened at the last meeting. But because there wasn't incidents of racism being reported to us, we would only be talking about the fact that Sudbury is such a good place, nothing bad happening, except, of course, with the Native people, and they had a Native advisory board that was almost defunct. I didn't feel we were doing much But however, we existed in case there was ever anything. And we had once a year for the day, for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination Day, we had a luncheon. And lots and lots and lots of people came, particularly Lou and I was the chair, because I begged them to come or asked them to come. And I'd phone like 150 people. And they'd come. So we would have these people show up and talk with each other and talk with the police. To that end, we served a purpose because I made sure that many of the police came. Unfortunately for me, I had taught many of those police in the law and security program at Cambrian. And I told them they've got to be nice to the public and make fun with them. But they were nice. And the people who I invited got to meet them and hang with them and know them in their communities. And we always had our police chief talk about the issues we would have. And one of the things that the police chief would say, my door is open. Paula has made it so that I've met many of you. My door is open. If you have any issues, come to me. And I want you to know, he said once, any policeman stopping a black man on the streets of Sudbury because they're in a fancy neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning or midnight, and he stops him for that reason, he doesn't have a job next day. Because that man could be living in that neighborhood. And when black people heard those things, that simple thing like that, with a chief saying, I will fire that person the next day. I think that in those ways we helped. The fact is that we were there in case anything bad happened.
It sounds like you have spent a lot of your life bringing people together.
Girl, it's funny you should say that. It seems to me that that's probably what they're going to put on my tombstone when I die, if I have a tombstone. I started that behavior. I didn't know that that's what, but now I'm famous for that. People say, Paula, you know everybody in Sudbury, and you bring everybody together. And, you know, I know people in high places, but I never saw them that they were in high places. They just like me, and I like them. So it's funny that when I started to teach at Cambrian College, many people, when they got to know me, would stop to talk to me. And then while I'm talking to them, I'm talking to this one woman, another woman passing by said, Paula, hi. And I would say, you know Sheila? Sheila, you know Dory? She's in the business department. And I would make the two of them become friends. And then they start to talk to each other. And then I would skip away because I want to go because I'm stopped in the hallway 50 times. I'm always escaping. And that's what I did. And then every summer, when my children came home for the 3 or 4 days that they give me out of their lives with the grandchildren, one comes from New York, one DC, and Sean comes up from Toronto, whichever the grand Jerry's children could come from Windsor. And we'd all meet here. And I'd invite 150 people. And I'd make a whole pile of curry chicken, let me tell you. Yeah, you find doctors and lawyers and this and that. But they're all just people, blacks and East Indians and everybody. And indeed, I guess I know all of Sudbury, or all of Sudbury knows me. So yes, I did bring a lot of people together in this world, in this whole world, and the friends in England and the friends in America, where so many of my brothers and sisters live, and those in Guyana. So yes, I've straddled a lot of worlds. And there it is. I don't know why you're building a teepee so 2 or 3 you could go in there. It's going to be full because you'll tell everybody to come.
That's right.
I heard that one of my neighbors thought that I was like a soothsayer.
Like a psychic?
Because every time she would see a car turning in the driveway, who's all these big shot cars coming to this little black woman?
You know, one of the things that I hear you saying, Paula, is that, you know, you bring people together, you introduce them to each other, you build community, you build new kinds of communities. And part of it is having good food. It's an expression of camaraderie. It's an expression of love. It's a force.
And it's demonstrated by things like just feeding people and packing them up baskets. I'm like meals on wheels here. People drive into my driveway to pick up curry chicken or something. I could have had a restaurant. But to me, that's all I have to give is food. So when people come to pick up my food, I tell them, I don't want you to stay and visit. I'm tired. I just, that's what I do. And to me, if people want to know what love is, I make the food with love. And I package it with love, and I send it, and the love goes. And when they eat it, they take a deep breath and say, this is wonderful. That's love. My children have learned it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, truly. And because all of your children are helping people, all of your children are engaged in their communities in a really serious way.
Yes, they do help, and they do bring the world together. and they talk about me all over the place, about their mother. I know you didn't call me for this interview to hear all this.
Oh, I totally did. I just wanted to hear from you.
I mean, and you know that you and I are now friends for life, let me tell you. Because you just walked straight into my chest, into my heart.
Oh, thank you, Paula. I value that. I really value that. It's a gift. Let me ask you one last serious question. When you see all these people wearing masks because of COVID and marching down the streets in every city in the States and also in Canada, really challenging the systemic racism that exists here.
Right.
When you see all of that and you think about everything that you've done and you think about your grandchildren, you've lived a lot of life and you've overcome a lot and you move through so many worlds. What do you say to the young people who are going through this moment?
Yeah, I'd like to answer that because I do have to say things to my white grandchildren, the black ones. It might seem simplistic, but I've often said to them, like Spike Lee said, do the right thing. And Michael Jackson said, start with the man in the mirror. I ask them to be good citizens, to not forget the struggle, to respect it. As McKenna would say, you have to dialogue. I want them to work with their friends in respectful ways. I have asked them, and I challenge myself, to start with the man in the mirror, as Michael Jackson says. What am I doing? I am embracing people. I raised 3 decent kids, my contribution to the world. I am hopeful that things will be better, much better, not in my lifetime, but the kids we are raising now are so bent on being inclusive and understanding and fair and decent and bright that the world has to get better. In spite of Trump, yeah, it will get better. And yeah, that's what I say. So many people will go out there and work for lots of money. Let them. And many people will go out there and work for lots of change. And I respect them. And I will join them. I will do my part. And I ask for everybody to do their part. We've got a whole bunch of socially conscious people around us. And I will have nothing less. That's what I have to say.
And that's what we all have to hear. Thank you, Paula. No matter what anyone else does with this interview, I'm going to listen to what you just said every day.
I'm kissing the phone because I'm kissing. I do that to my grandchildren.
Everybody needs a grandmother like you in their lives, Paula. Everybody.
You know, I was tired indeed. But you know, I've been invigorated. Hearing myself get angry and knowing that I am angry at some of the stuff, we've never had time to delve into things like that. I haven't done that. And so they don't know what exists in me. They love me for just being nice, decent, well-spoken, not too ugly looking, yeah, woman, and yeah, non-judgmental and whatever else they call me. But they don't know the extent of my angst at how I am perceived by the black family and the white family. Mm-hmm. And I just had a chance to explain that to you.
And it's a real gift, Paula, to share those deep feelings. I really thank you for that. I really honor it. It's not an easy thing to do.
Okay. And then now I'm a high point. I'm out of bed. I'm walking while I'm talking to you.
Now. Oh, fantastic. I love that.
I'm walking. Take care, my darling.
Okay. Take good care.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Lansberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.